The days of cheap food are rapidly coming to an end, and the prices we city people will have to pay for animal protein may well be out of sight. And so today we pause to ask, can we raise livestock in the city?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 586th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over the way down there in Pucallpa who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Parmley Taff.
Hello.
Carol Stafford is out there on the phones. Hello, Carol. Folks, during the Great Depression, a very important event for many families was the Sunday meal of fried chicken. This meal was an important event because it brought the family together, for one thing, but in addition, it fed them an affordable protein. Chicken was affordable during the Great Depression because most everybody raised their own chickens. Now, cut away to today, where we city people raise no chickens. Fortunately, today we are not in the midst of a Great Depression, and there is a giant factory in some distant land that is cranking out chickens at an affordable rate so we can all be fed some animal protein. But wait. The price of animal feed is going through the roof, and there are millions of new customers and consumers in the world who now have the money to buy some protein. Looking into the future, we know that that giant chicken factory is going to sell its products to the highest bidder, and we wonder if we will be the ones who will have the money to buy it. And so, coming back to today, we pause to ask, can we raise our livestock in the city? Here to help us explore the question, we have Professor Emeritus Richard Gradwall, an animal breeder with Happy Mountain Miniature Cattle up there, right underneath the slopes of Mount Rainier. Right, Professor? Let's see. Let's press this button and I'll have you. Richard, you there?
Yes, I'm here. You bet.
Good. So you're right up underneath the slopes of Mount Rainier, right?
You betcha.
Is it raining today?
Oh, we got a nice sunshiny day today.
And when it's sunshiny there, it's so beautiful.
Oh, it's gorgeous up there.
Such gorgeous country. Yes, also with us, we have Professor Jennifer Blecka, who will be joining us as soon as she gets into her hotel room in Boston someplace. But let's start off with you, Richard.
Sure.
You've been in agriculture, or teaching in agriculture for many, many years, right?
About 34 years.
34 years. And you are now developing, or have been developing for a number of years, miniature cattle.
You bet, yeah.
Tell us how you became involved with miniature cattle.
Well, you know, we're in a place called Kent, Washington. And when the city of Seattle just keeps growing, and King County is the county that the city of Seattle's in, and it just keeps growing. And we had a farm not too far from where I'm located now, but it was a large farm. And as the city of Seattle just kept growing, and the taxes just kept going up and up and up, the real estate taxes on the land. So we were forced into a situation where we had to sell off pieces of our acreage so we could afford what we had left. And we ended up with, over a period of time selling off land, we ended up with 5 acres. And we had big Herefords and big Angus, and you know, it was obvious that the big animals just weren't going to work on small acreage. So we came to the conclusion that maybe we could do something along the lines of small animals. And at that time, that was around 1960. And also I took a trip around the United States looking for smaller bovine, and I found a herd in South Carolina that was the original herd. It was a closed herd. And those animals had been brought over here from Europe. And they were the same animals that were raised by the British in the 1700s and 1800s.
If you've ever been in a house built in the 1700s and 1800s, you'll know that people were not very big then either, were they?
Oh, that's true. That's very, very true. You know, 5 acres in England is an estate.
Yeah.
So what they were trying to do is to create animals that were smaller, that were very feed efficient, that they could raise quite a few on small acreage and still have a good beef source, good protein source. And so we got some of those animals, and then we started following the methodology of the British. The British are the ones that created most of the breeds of domesticated cattle in the world. They've created 850 different breeds. So we followed the methodology.
850 different breeds of cattle?
850 different breeds of cattle have been created by the British. And so we followed their lead and started doing crossbreeding and 2-breed triple crossing and 4-breed crossing, 5-breed crossing. And we ended up developing quite a number of breeds of miniature cattle.
Before we go on, mm-hmm. why miniature? Because everybody in America was going for bigger and bigger and bigger, and you're going for smaller and smaller and smaller. So it's kind of like... It's kind of like almost you're a heretic of some kind.
Well, when everybody was breeding bigger, I was breeding smaller. Everybody thought, "What in the world are you doing?" And but I've since proved them all wrong. I hope anyway. The neat thing about it is that when you have smaller animals, you can raise more per acre, and you know, so on 5 acres, for example, you can raise 2 smaller animals per acre, 2 miniature cattle per acre, so you can raise 10 animals on 5 acres. And they're going to weigh around 600 pounds average. With larger cattle, you can raise 2 per 5 acres, and they're going to weigh around, you know, 1,200 pounds per average. So in terms of live weight beef, with the larger animals on 5 acres, you've got 2,400 pounds. Of live weight beef. With the smaller animals, you've got 6,000 pounds of live weight beef. So your production per acre is significantly higher with the smaller animals than it is with the larger animals. And that's very important nowadays because, as you know, the United States has been broken up into little pieces, and small farms of 5, 10, 15 acres are the way it is now. And the 1,000, 2,000 acre farms are gone. And not very many of those left around.
Well, in you, I find a fellow heretic, I guess, because when I came out with the book Metro Farm, talking about how people could make a good living by farming a small parcel of land,
uh-huh.
all of the ag economists looked at me and talked at me and spoke of me as I was crazy or something.
Sure. Yeah.
Now they.
I know the feeling.
So what happens when you go to a National Cattlemen's Association meeting and with these miniature cattle?
I don't go.
You don't go.
I don't go. They kind of poo-poo me, you know. But on the sly, I've had many cattle breeders that are raising big animals call me and want to know if I have semen that I could send them, because they want to start breeding their animals down because they recognize the theory that more animals per acre makes more sense when they have smaller acreage. So we had a lot of people order semen from us, but they don't tell their buddies, you know.
And there's one other hugely significant thing about what you're doing, and that's a notion that's coming into play these days, is the importance of grass-fed animals.
Oh, yeah.
In the past, we have moved our animals off grass and onto grain.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, we lose out on the long-chain omega-3 fatty acids.
That's very correct.
That's produced when ruminants eat grass. When they eat the grains, they no longer produce those long-chain omega-3 fatty acids, and we miss them now in our diets, much to our detriment. But what you're talking about is the ability to greatly enhance the ability of feeding grass to animals, uh-huh. are you not?
Yeah, you know, the miniature cattle we've developed, and we've developed these 18 breeds, and they're extremely feed efficient. So they convert, you know, their food source to muscle you know, at a high rate of efficiency. They're about, you know, you can feed them about one third of what a large animal takes, and you still get a considerable amount of beef with one third the feed.
And that's the benefit.
Oh, yeah.
Folks, for many decades, we took pride in living the good life of cheap food, but that was yesterday, and yesterday's gone. Today, the price of food is going through the roof, and so we ask, can we raise livestock in the city? Here to talk about that with us, we have Professor Emeritus Richard Gradwall, an animal breeder from Happy Mountain Miniature Cattle, and also we have Professor Jennifer Black. I'll introduce her when we get back from this break. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Please do stay. Stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Somewhere out there, way out there, there's a giant factory that's pumping out chickens at an affordable rate so that you and I can have some animal protein in our diets. But, wow, the price of animal feed is going through the roof, and there are millions and millions of new people out there who can afford to buy those chickens, and you know that factory's going to sell them to the highest bidder. And what if we're no longer the highest bidder? So that's something that we pause to think about once in a while, and today we're asking, as a consequence, can we grow livestock in the city? Here to talk to us about that, we have Professor Emeritus Richard Gradwall, who is an animal breeder up in the state of Washington, but he breeds small cattle when the rest of America is breeding big cattle. And coming from Montana, I know a lot of those ranchers who are breeding the big cattle, and I know none that are breeding the little ones. But this is an immensely fascinating possibility because, Richard, you say that those miniature cattle, you can produce much more beef on much less land, right?
That's for sure. You bet.
Well, also with us today, we're fortunate enough to have Professor Jennifer Blecka, a human geographer from San Francisco State University. Jennifer, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hello.
Human geographer?
Well, sure. Some geographers study physical Earth phenomena, and human geographers study people's relationships with the environment and why they do the things they do, where they do them.
Mm-hmm. And you received a PhD on a dissertation about breed animals in the city, right?
That's right. Urban livestock in
the
U.S.
Urban livestock. Is it really something that's coming back, or is it my imagination?
No, it is coming back. And what's strange, really, is this historical anomaly of the 20th century when it wasn't really happening in U.S. cities very much. Throughout history, animals have always existed as part of cities. Even up till the turn of the 20th century in the U.S., there were lots of cows and lots of horses and lots of pigs, well, maybe into the middle of the 19th century, in most U.S. cities. Before there were refrigerated rail cars, you had to grow your meat and your dairy products in the city,
close,
or very close to it. Otherwise, it would spoil by the time it got to the city.
And so, until very recently, that was the way we did things. And
mm-hmm.
as Richard was talking about earlier, when we were talking about miniature cattle, in England, cattle are small. And
mm-hmm.
So Richard went there to begin his effort to breed a much smaller animal for much smaller parcels of land. And you, when I talked with you briefly, you talked about how miniature animals present a real interesting opportunity.
Sure. Well, a lot of people in cities are growing animals that are sort of naturally smaller, chickens and rabbits, and people keep beehives, a few ducks. But recently, some cities are starting to look at other animals. Seattle, last fall, changed its ordinances to allow dairy goats in people's backyards in the city of Seattle, miniature dairy goat breeds. So there are a couple different breeds of goats that people can keep. And I imagine if we had small enough cows, that would become a possibility, too.
Well, let's talk about what kinds of animals would be most conducive to bringing back to the city, to a city that's essentially grown up without them, and
right.
and so therefore has no real institutional knowledge of how to have animals in the first place. Where would we start?
Probably with hens, chicken hens. Most cities prohibit roosters because of noise.
Cock-a-doodle-doo.
I kind of like them,
but you know, when you get a bunch of them, it's a different story.
Yeah, and some people do keep roosters, and as long as their neighbors don't mind, then nobody really bothers, you know. So a lot of them check with their neighbors, and their neighbors say, oh, it sounds so great, you know, I grew up on a farm, and it reminds me of that. Or, but in most cases, you have too many neighbors, and somebody needs to sleep in a little. You can keep hens very easily in a city, two or three or five hens. And chickens, they lay eggs whether there's a rooster there or not. And a lot of people don't know that, but hens lay an egg every day whether there's a rooster or not. It's just not fertilized.
Right, right.
So you get all the benefits. The chickens will eat pests from your garden.
Right.
They create manure that you can put on your garden. They're a sociable animal. My chickens love to be picked up. They come running when I go in the back. People report a lot of positive social effects with their neighbors. Neighbors that they lived next to for years and never really had a conversation with now come over and visit the chickens, and they give them eggs, and they trade for some vegetables or trade for, you know, some barter. Hens are a really easy way to start.
And when I introduced the show, I talked about how during the Great Depression, you know, Sunday meals were a fried chicken dinner. And the reason, you know, people could afford chickens dinners was because they were raising chickens. Most everybody did back then, but few do now. And so you live in a city and have chickens.
Yes. Chickens are legal and recognized in a lot of U.S. cities. Nobody has really done a thorough study of all the regulations, but I started one this spring. I looked at 105 cities in the U.S. and Canada, all the state capitals and all the largest cities of each state where it wasn't the same as the capital. So I had 105 cities. And in the U.S., 66% of the cities I looked at allowed hens. And only 20% prohibited it, and about 11% didn't mention them. And so there, even you could do it until somebody complains, you know. So it's really a possibility in a lot of places. Now, a lot of cities, and I think it's totally reasonable for cities to have some limits on it. Like, a lot of regulations will say a limit of the number of animals you can have, or the distance it has to be from the neighbor's house, or, you know, it must be kept in a proper and cleanly fashion. Or no roosters. But other than that, having hens or having a couple ducks or having a couple rabbits or something like that, it's less trouble than a dog. Usually they don't bark, they don't bite.
And you don't have to take them for walks. Well, Richard, you live in a city and you have cattle.
Yeah, we're the last farm in the city of Covington, Washington.
And how is it that you have cattle in a city?
Well, we had the farm was here before the city.
So the city grew up around you, and you were kind of grandfathered in, as it were.
Exactly. And right now we have big, huge housing developments on three sides of us, so we're kind of overwhelmed with population here. And it's getting more difficult to, you know, of course the city would rather, you know, I sell the property and let somebody build houses here, but we like it here.
Now, how does the neighborhood react with your cattle?
Well, we haven't had any problems. You know, we did require when the When the developer put the houses around us, we did require that he put up a 10-foot-high fence, solid fence. The reason for that was we were concerned about pesticide drift. And we are an organic farm, so pesticide drift would, you know, just murder us. And so he put up this large fence, and that's seemed to have, you know, made it so that we don't have any problems with pesticides. The other thing is that the children, you know, find it difficult to climb over a 10-foot fence and get into the pastures.
So, mm-hmm. And there being open space, you know, remembering back to my childhood, that'd be the first place that I would go is for the open space. Yeah, of course.
Into the pasture with the bulls, you know.
Right.
And that doesn't work too well, so the large fence tends to do that. But we have, you know, we just haven't had any complaints from the neighbors that I'm aware
of. So it really is possible to have animals in the city.
Sure.
Both of you are doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're bringing animals back to the city, and we have a couple people who are very good at it. We have a human geographer, Professor Jennifer Blecka from San Francisco State University, who did a PhD thesis on animals in cities. We have Professor Emeritus Richard Gradwell, who is an animal breeder with Happy Mountain Miniature Cattle, breeding 26 different kinds of miniature cattle, Richard?
Yeah, that's true. Right.
Wow. And, of course, we have you. Pick up your phone and join us today if you like. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. What kind of animals would you bring back to the city? And we're thinking, of course, about food animals, too. So pick up your phone and join us. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Well, folks, there are millions of people out there who can now afford to buy more food. And the food they would like to buy is animal protein, or at least many of them would like to buy animal protein. And, of course, that food will go to those who can afford to pay for it. And today we can afford to pay for it, but will that always be true? And if it isn't true, then how will we feed ourselves? Is it possible we could do so by bringing animals back into the city? As Jennifer Blecka, Professor Jennifer Blecka from San Francisco State, has said, that's always the way it was throughout history until only very recently did it change. So that's the question on the table today. We have Professor Richard Gradwell, who is an animal breeder from Happy Mountain Miniature Cattle, and Professor Jennifer Blecka, a human geographer from San Francisco State, and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Let's go to the phones and talk with Tony. Tony, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning. I'm curious, what's the size of your miniature beef cattle, and what weight are they being produced at? And also, where would you raise these in the city? Would you use the zoos? Would you use parks or create parks for them? What are some of the logistics of being able to create a cattle ranch or a small cattle farm in the city areas?
Okay, when I talk about city, I generally refer to metropolitan areas, which to me includes anything that's in or near a city. But let's go and talk with Richard. Richard, what does it take to start a cattle operation with miniature cattle?
Good. Well, your caller's got some very good questions. Generally, height-wise, you're looking at anywhere from 36 inches to 42 inches. And that would be a miniature cattle. If they're over 42, up to 48, they're considered a mid-size. But we have them here at our farm that we have quite a number of them that are 36, 37 inches.
So we're talking a yard?
Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah.
But that's like up to my knees.
Mm-hmm, yeah, exactly, exactly. We got one little bull. It's named Giovanni. Giovanni is 36 inches tall, and he's out in the pasture doing breeding, making other taller animals have small babies, you might say. So
he must use a stepladder.
Well, he's pretty good. That's all I can say.
Huh.
But he's good at what he does.
So
weight-wise, your caller asked about weight. You're looking at, you know, 400 to 700 pounds. Depending on, you know, how big. Some of the smaller ones, like 36 inches, will be, you know, 350 to 450. Where can you put them? Well, you know, you need, the concentration is 2 per acre. So,
and we're talking about grass-fed animals here, correct?
Yeah.
I mean, most of animal agriculture has gone to confinement facilities.
And yeah, feedlots.
Feedlots, yes. And what we're talking about is pasture-fed or grass-fed animals, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
So what kind of land would it take?
Well, you know, if you have 1 acre, you can put two animals. If you have a large backyard that's a half acre, you could put one animal. So, you know, it's not really a matter of where the land is. It's a matter of the zoning. Some cities, we've sold animals all over the United States, and some cities, you know, don't restrict the use of small cattle because they're basically large dogs, and about the same as a large dog. So as long as it's a small animal, they don't seem to have any problem with it. But if you have a big animal like a big Hereford or a big Angus, well, sure, you know, something around 70 inches tall is a little different program. But if you have a large backyard and the zoning will allow it, you know, you can put miniature cattle back there, you know, 1 acre, one animal.
Huh. Jennifer Bleck, you've looked at the zoning throughout the United States. Have you ever seen zoning restrictions for miniature animals like the cattle or hogs even?
Yes, a lot of cities, it's looking at regulations in cities, it's really interesting because some of them say exactly what you may have, mm-hmm. and then other ones say what you may not have. And they vary widely from city to city. Some of them, it depends on the size of the lot. Some of them are pretty open. They just say, you know, like, you may not have wild and vicious animals or something. Uh-huh. And others are very restrictive, and they say positively, farm animals are incommensurate with urban life. They are not allowed at all, none. So every person needs to go and look at their ordinances. You just go on your city website and look under codes or ordinances, and it should tell you. There should usually Chapter 8 has regulations about animals listed. But I didn't look specifically for regulations of cattle in this recent survey I did. I did look for goats, pigs, bees, rabbits, ducks, roosters, and hens. And I was surprised to find how many cities did allow even goats and pigs. And I looked for non-potbelly pigs, which are usually considered pets. Mm-hmm. So I looked for larger pigs, and a lot of cities do allow them. So in quite a few cities, I imagine you could even keep small cattle.
Okay.
Yeah, well, that's very true.
Let's go to Rich, who has a question. Rich, welcome to the food chain.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Why can't we just breed larger chickens instead of smaller cows?
good
one cow per acre, you get a lot of chickens, even larger ones on that.
Mm-hmm. And what about raising, like our good friend Joel Salatin does in the Shenandoah River Valley, why not raise chickens with your cattle and take care of the manure problems? Good question, Rich. Let's start with Jennifer. Jennifer? Raise bigger chickens?
True. I've never thought of it. I don't really know why a person would need a bigger chicken, just get a couple more. If you have lots of acreage, you don't need a 60-pound chicken running around. Just get a few more of them, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are benefits. A lot of people who keep chickens are not doing it for meat because they are, you know, maybe they're even vegetarian and they have trouble sort of killing the animals that they get to know.
Hold on for just a second, Jennifer. I'm going to see if I can fix that squeal. Are you back?
Yes. Yeah,
okay, go ahead.
Okay. So a lot of people are raising animals that they can just use either the eggs or the milk or the honey from and not necessarily the meat. So chickens are good that way, as are our dairy goats. I'm kind of curious whether there are any miniature dairy cows or is he raising only beef cattle?
Richard?
Yeah, I've developed three breeds that are dairy breeds, the Lesser Jersey, the American Beltie, and the miniature Holstein. At our farm, we have the first miniature Holstein. She's 38 inches tall, and she's pregnant, so that's interesting. You know, Jennifer is absolutely right. Another aspect of what Jennifer just said is the fact that in beef, I assume it would be the same in chickens, but the taller the animal, when you have a tall animal, the muscle cell is a striated, long, cylindrical cell in tall animals. And short animals, you have a real short cell. The shorter the cell in the muscle, the more tender the beef. So that's another reason why miniature cattle are significantly more tender than on a grass-fed basis than larger cattle are. And I assume that it might be the same with chickens. If you had big chickens, you wouldn't have the high degree of tenderness that some of the small ones have.
Wow, what a question, what an answer. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We are talking about bringing animals back to the city, and we've got a couple of very interesting people to help us do that. And we have, of course, you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back with Richard Gradhole and Jennifer Blecka, and you right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about bringing animals back into our city like they were throughout history. Jennifer, when did we start chasing animals out of the city?
Well, in the middle of the 19th century, a new thought finally occurred to people, which was about the source of disease. The sanitary movement began. People began to realize that maybe big piles of manure and human waste and vegetable trimmings and all dead dogs and everything in the sidewalks of the city might not be a good idea for health, and that might have been contributing.
It was actually that way. I mean,
yes, it was. In fact, the major garbage collection service in New York in the 19th century consisted of pigs, wild pigs roaming the streets and eating all this trash, human waste, animal waste. Bodies,
whatever.
Yeah, everything. It was
pigs being pigs. Yeah.
It was knee deep in most places. It was a terrible situation, and so in a lot of the city, tens of thousands of hogs were running around Manhattan and Brooklyn, eating all this garbage, and that was the protein source for poor people. And in fact, in the 1820s and 30s, the city started trying to get rid of the pigs, and they would send hog collectors down. And the people rioted. There were hog riots in Manhattan with poor people protesting and saying, don't take our hogs away. We need those to eat. But finally, there was a big cholera epidemic in the late 1840s. And so the city finally got the upper hand and drove all the pigs out of Manhattan by about 1860.
Well, we see cities protecting themselves ostensibly with lots of rules and regulations and laws prohibiting the raising of livestock within cities. One sometimes thinks that these laws, though, were really designed to protect somebody else's industry rather than protect us from the neighbor's chickens. Do you see a way around all of these laws and rules and regulations? This is a question for both of you to make it possible for people who live in metropolitan areas to bring back animals back into the city, to the metropolitan area. Let's start with you, Jennifer.
Well, I do. A lot of cities actually do still allow them. Strangely enough, more like center cities, big cities, are more tolerant of productive animals than are a lot of suburbs.
You know, you and I were both in Milwaukee here a few weeks ago, and I just think of all of the, Milwaukee's a Rust Belt city. It has a lot of space that isn't being used these days. And I just wonder about how, and Milwaukee is one of those municipalities who's really becoming quite friendly toward metropolitan agriculture. Do you see that as a possibility, bringing animals back into a situation like that?
Definitely. Some of the cities like Detroit and Milwaukee both are becoming very open to urban agriculture, and there are a lot of organizations starting up for gardening, community gardening, home gardening, using vacant lots as food production sites, and I think animals could play a real part in that.
Richard?
Yeah, I would agree with Jennifer and you also that bringing animals back to an urban area would be a real possibility. While Jennifer was talking, I was thinking about my own situation. We have about 200 or 300 homes on three sides of us here, and we've had neighbors actually you know, visit our farm, and we have an open house once a year, and they come and visit us and talk to us, and we've had a lot of them say how they enjoy living next to the farm. It's so much fun hearing the mooing and so on and so forth. So there's an example here, I think, that people who have never lived on a farm and don't know anything about farming appreciate, you know, the farm life, even though they don't participate in it themselves.
And I also wonder about, you know, how we, as we grow farther and farther and farther away from our food, how that creates a certain insecurity in our lives as well. And to be next to a farm, for example, just might lend a little security. Like, hey, there's actually somebody who grows food in the world, right?
Sure.
Let's go to Pure Heart. Pure Heart, welcome to the food chain. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you.
Yeah, hi, Michael and guests. My first chickens, I got in fourth grade, I hatched her in a shoebox with a light bulb. And she was with me till I was a sophomore in college. Just me and Tommy, some others, you know, a chicken.
Uh-huh.
Well, my question, though, when you go to a feed store, you get a bunch of chicks. You often get extra roosters you don't really want. So what? How do you deal with excess roosters besides chicken soup?
Well, that's, we usually chop their head off and eat them.
Okay.
Jennifer?
I ran into that a lot. In doing my dissertation, I interviewed a whole bunch of families in Seattle and Portland who were raising chickens. And most of them, although they bought what were supposed to be sexed chicks and they only wanted girls, almost everybody ended up with one or two roosters accidentally. And they did a variety of different things. Some of them advertised and found other homes for them in the country. Some of them did eat them. A couple of them donated them to a zoo as food for the alligators.
Uh-huh.
Most of them were pretty concerned to try to keep them out of cockfighting rings, which seemed to be an option for people who might want to, you know, pick them up. And some people were able to keep them because their neighbors didn't mind.
Yeah.
I've started the incessant biting and the whatnot, but do you know if animal shelters will accept them or they just kill them?
Well, in Minneapolis, there's a fabulous organization called Chicken Rescue, and they take in hundreds of roosters a year and find homes for them.
Wow.
But I think that's pretty rare.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Jennifer Blecka, Richard Gredhall, and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We have a few minutes left. When we get back, we'll have a lot more fun right back. We're back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about bringing animals back to the city with Jennifer Blecka, a human geographer from San Francisco State. Also, we have Richard Gradwell, who is an animal breeder with Happy Mountain Miniature Cattle. And also, we have Carrie on the line. Carrie, welcome to The Food Chain.
Thanks.
Fire away,
girl. I just have a comment to share based on what people have been talking about. I keep chickens in the Twin Cities. And first of all, I think that I shouldn't really confess this on the radio, but I think one of the ways around the law is I did the neighbor permit where all my neighbors signed the chicken form, like the permission.
Oh, really?
But I never actually turned it into the city because then they can come and inspect things, and in case of an outbreak, they would probably confiscate the chickens.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I did get permission from my neighbors, and it was a really interesting experience because I had to talk with my neighbors about what would happen if there were bird flu, and we live in an area where there are a lot of Hmong immigrants, and the response from my Hmong neighbors was, "You don't have chickens already." And so, it's been an interesting bridge between me as a single white female homeowner and my Hmong neighbors, because we all keep chickens now, and so I've had more conversations with my neighbors. And my 85-year-old neighbor takes care of my chickens, and she said that it's just a delight to hold a warm egg in her hand again. And so it's been a conversation starter and kind of a, I would say, a community building experience.
You know, it's interesting because in talking about people, for example, who have spent time in the Tuscany, they say the single most important element that they do in their day-to-day life is talk to their neighbors, because the neighbors are the ones who watch over them and take care of them. And it's kind of what you have going there, isn't it, Carrie? You have neighbors now.
Yep, and I hadn't spoken to them in the 3 years that I've lived in my house, essentially, and then I had to make sure that they were okay with the chickens. And the neighbors will let their neighbor kids come over now and pick June bugs off the grapevine to feed the chickens all summer, which I think is a lot more positive an experience than maybe spending the summer inside on their computers, and I get to know them, and so that's been really fun.
That was a wonderful call. Thank you, Carrie. Wow.
Thanks.
So, Jennifer, I guess what you were talking about is absolutely true. It builds a little neighborhood there, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And that's one key point I'd just like to make before the end of the show here, which is, you started with the premise of, food prices going up, and so that being an impetus for us to raise animals in
the
city.
But not the only one, is it?
But it sure isn't. And I would say that, while urban livestock can provide a huge proportion of, I think there's a lot of potential there for food production, and in many other cities of the world, in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, it does provide, half, two-thirds even of the animal protein for residents of the city. We can do that, out of necessity, but there's so many other benefits, and those are often the ones that push people in the U.S. to do it, at least for now, and those include sort of an ethical feeling. A lot of people are very concerned about the life conditions of animals in confinement operations in factory farms.
Let me ask quickly how to get in touch with Jennifer Blacka.
I am on the verge of starting a website and a blog called Urban Livestock, but for the time being, look on the San Francisco State University Geography
and
website.
And then also, Richard, how do we get in touch with you?
Well, we got a website, and that's www.minicattle.com.
Thank you all for tuning in. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio. Remember, cheap food isn't. Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.